The committee will come to order.
Thank you. And we don't have a quorum yet, so we'll move the minutes in a little bit. But I would like to, today we're having a presentation from the Office of Early Learning. And this office is based in the Department of Education, but it works closely with both the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services. So it's three departments working very closely together around a very important subject, our little children. Up front, I'd like to say something about early learning. I think we'll find this weaving throughout the presentations, the awareness that the child needs to be with positive, responsive, nurturing adults, and that learning that builds their complex neural networks in their brain that has a chance to build and stabilize under those circumstances when they're with adults that are responsive and nurturing. And this sets the foundation for later academics and actually good health too. But we cannot separate how children are cared for, child care, and early learning. They are actually the same thing. We can't say that kids are off in child care over here and they'll have learning later. It is one and the same thing. So I just like to emphasize that up front, and I think, as I said, I think that'll probably weave through our presentation. But with that, we have Dr. Karen Cadigan from the Department of Education. Would you like to come down and introduce yourself further and then proceed?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Karen Cadigan. I'm the Director of the Office of Early Learning at Minnesota's Department of Education. We're headquartered. I like to think of my role as head shepherdess among three state agencies and a variety of programs that impact young children and their families. Thanks for starting out talking about terms, young children's development. You're going to hear the terms development, health, learning, education. Many of those terms are interchangeable. So before we get going, I think it's great to get us all in the mindset of sort of a both-and mindset about young children. My colleagues from the other two agencies are going to join me in a moment. But first wanted to give you an overview of the amount of information and the structure of information that we're here to share today. We wanted to give you an overview of programs in all three of our agencies that touch birth through third graders, especially birth to five-year-olds. And so imagine getting an overview of the entire K-12 system in an hour and a half. We'll do our best, but hopefully as we go on here, if there are policies or programs or funding streams or issues that you have, you want to take a deeper dive on, either during committee or at other times, of course, let us know. So this is a little bit of a buffet for the pickings for you. So a little bit of an overview about why early development matters. Some words about what the Office of Early Learning is from a governance standpoint. And then we'll go through rather quickly the programs and policies in each of the three agencies, Health, Human Services, and Education. Then we'll pause to talk a little bit in specific about the Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge Grant and some of the ways that that is giving us great opportunity right now that we haven't had before. And hopefully we'll have time for 20 to 30 minutes of your questions. So that's where we're headed. Before we get started, though, wanted to talk a little bit about the importance of the science of early development. In the last few decades, we have come really to understand a lot more about young children's development. And the brain, there's all kinds of interesting research about brain development, and I'm going to try to summarize that for you in about 5 minutes, so bear with me as I do that. So the human brain is the only organ in the body that is not fully developed at birth. The brain continues to develop throughout our lives, of course, but it changes dramatically in the first 5 to 6 years. Analogies for this that you might have heard about are drying cement or drying clay, or often people think of young children as a sponge soaking up information around them. But in the earliest years, in the first 1,000 days of life, especially, a better analogy is really developing architecture. And that is that during these years, this time of life is unique, and the brain is developing architecture in a way that has three characteristics. It's fast, flexible and foundational. And just to go through that a little bit more fast, in that in a number of weeks and months, young children go from not being able to control even the most basic movements of their eyes and limbs and body, as we see here in this three-day-old, to being more responsive to their environment and to being able to control their bodies, respond to the environment, imitate increasingly complex sounds, and initiate movement and action. There's a reason that I usually don't report to people my age as 5,200 months. There's a reason that we talk about young children by order of months. When you ask someone, oh, is your baby 8 months? They'll say, oh, no, she's 10 months, because there is a big difference just in months at this point in development. Babies are actually programmed to learn from their environments right away, so that, for example, in the first days of life, the first distance a baby can see clearly is about 6 to 8 inches away from their face, where the caregiver's face would be. Babies are programmed for learning. They're born learning. So it's not a matter of if they're learning, but what they're learning, really. No other period of development is as rapid, although changes can be made later, of course, to skills that aren't learned in this short period of time, but it's a little bit like missing your exit on the freeway, in that the further you go down the developmental path, the longer you have to get back if there are things that you miss during this really early window of development. And this development is flexible in that it really responds to the environment, to prompts around. Babies respond to things around them, what they can see, what they hear, what they can reach, and if it's nurturing, responsive, it promotes brain development. If there's sustained high levels of stress, what we call toxic stress, the brain can literally be damaged. It's not just the baby would cry and fuss more, but the architecture of the brain can literally be damaged. So the most important dimension, though, of development, I think from a policy standpoint, the most important dimension of development in the early years is that it's foundational. So that it's not just that children develop quickly and learn based on what's around them, but by the time children are age 3, for example, they really have the foundational skills of complex language, turn-taking, self-regulation, self-control, expression, emotion, humor, increased motor coordination, problem solving, all these things that add up to being eventually a competent older person. They have those things or they don't. So here we really focus just on the first 3 years, and I don't mean, certainly this conversation is not just about the first 3 years, but in the sake of time and just to highlight for you a little bit of the science, we wanted to highlight that area. Another interesting thing, though, about by the time children enter kindergarten, for example, by the time they're 5, all language structures are pretty much in place. The only thing that happens for language development, typical language development after that, is learning vocabulary. So it's, and just to really hit home on this point, that early experience literally shapes the brain. This is a slide that I hesitate to show because I think it's a lot disturbing. These are brain slices from 2 different children the same age, and you can see a couple of things. One is that the size of the brain is different, and the second is that the black space that you see there is empty space. The white or gray space on the slide is really gray matter. So, and again, not that development can't happen throughout the lifespan, but the early years are really incredibly important. The good news about all of this is that these differences are not due to, in almost all cases, just a genetic impact. They're due to environments, and environments can be changed. And that's, I think, that should be a really positive message for all of us. And hopefully you can keep that in mind and help us in thinking about the programs we have, because in the end, the programs that we have are bound to support and impact the environments in which young children and their families live. So also, just to hit home a little bit on this foundational aspect of development, you know, the things that we worry about a lot, a prepared workforce, things that we worry about a lot for tomorrow, a prepared workforce and high school graduation rates and third grade rating, all of those later achievement gaps, many of them may well be rooted in opportunity gaps of today. So, for example, there are some great studies about language skills for young children. And in the first 3 years, the numbers of words, literally the numbers of words heard and the kinds of language children hear, predict their vocabulary skills, which predicts their later academic skills. And these differences often persist through, these are national studies, these two slides, often persist even later. So these are, this slide is a big national data set about differences in reading skills at kindergarten, that's the red bar, and by fifth grade. And so if you think of the line there, the middle horizontal line is average, and those two sets on the left are below average, and the two sets on the right are above average, and you can see that the lines are the same, that basically by group, again, we can't predict what an individual child will do, but by groups of children, if you start behind, you're more likely to stay behind without further interventions. So what does all this have to do with policy? Part of it is that, so we know this this quick sum up of the science of early development, fast, flexible, foundational. There are two important sort of contextual settings in which early childhood occurs. One is that, and this might sound kind of silly, but early childhood occurs during early parenthood. So young children are more likely to have younger parents than older children are. Minnesota's parents are also Minnesota's workers, and so most children in Minnesota are in non-parental care some of the time. And this care is a combination of child care, preschool, full-day kindergarten across this age range. One of the differences, the average cost of care in Minnesota for high-quality child care or preschool full-time is greater than the cost of a year of tuition, books, and fees at the University of Minnesota. But the difference about the early years is families don't have 18 years to save up. And also there's not a per-pupil expenditure necessarily. So there's kind of this interesting history of public policy that is a little bit that makes access and quality sort of spotty, and that's where I think our work comes in today. The work that we're doing at the Office of Early Learning and your work as a legislature is how to improve on that. So, children. The big point here is that children are in non-parental care anyway. Many children. And the quality of that care is not always sufficient. Even when there are programs that are using public money, the quality of that care is not always sufficient to help get kids ready for school. And so we want to make improvements on that in ways, again, that make impact today and also are sustained through tomorrow. So just two more quick slides about the gap. These are our, in Minnesota, we've done a school readiness study for most of the last 10 years. And depending on the year between, most of the years between 42 and 46% of young kids were not ready for kindergarten. And the things that predict that not being ready for kindergarten in a way that aligns with third grade proficiency are again, environmental dimensions that jive completely with national research, and that is a lot of it has to do with family income, family education, and that's for a variety of reasons. And our later proficiency, of course, our third grade proficiency, is struck by gaps as well, with white children doing better than most all age groups, and that same thing is seen in high school graduation rates, so that most of the kids that are graduating within 4 years are doing so, are middle to higher income kids, whereas almost half of kids who are from families of low income don't finish high school in 4 years. So these things all add up. So I'm going to call up my colleague from the Department of Health in a moment. How's it pronounced? But I wanted to, since this is a crew that is interested in education. I wanted to, and Peter was kind enough to print out a full page of this slide, of this chart for you. I just wanted to give you a sum up of sort of the way the early childhood system works compared to K-12 by way of talking about who the sort of clients or the children are that are served in numbers, what the sort of governance structure looks like. So for K-12, there are 339 school districts and charter scale schools. In the early childhood world, thinking about child care, preschool, and Head Start, there are still those 339 school districts and charters and also 961 centers, over 11,000 licensed family child care providers, 52 Head Start programs. So you can see there are a lot of people involved in doing that good work. The licensing and governance and also financing is also just a little bit more complicated than, if you can imagine something more complicated than K-12 financing. And I'll be happy to jump through that. So the reason that we're here as three agencies is that about a couple of years ago, there was legislation to study the issue of whether Minnesota should have an Office of Early Learning. So the structure historically has looked kind of like this, that there are programs and policies in each of these three agencies, Department of Human Services, Department of Education, Department of Health, and that they're separate. And so some states have created a separate Office of Early Learning, like an Office of Higher Ed, having an Office of Early Ed. Other states have moved programs into one agency. In Minnesota, the recommendation of this task force was for there to be a separate freestanding cabinet-level agency, but that did not happen for a variety of reasons, and so what happened instead was the appointment of a chief, as I said before, shepherdess. And the reason that matters is not about creating more layers, but the reason that sort of governance and organization and a cross-sector collective leadership style matters is that even with the same ingredients, even if we just take the same programs and policies that each of our agencies have, if there's common vision and common planning, that it could be the difference from this to this. And so that's another way to depict the Office of Early Learning, that we're just connected through arrows, and it's really been a tremendous year and a half. And of course, the first thing that we did was with the team of private partners wrote and earned the $45 million Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge Grant, which I'll talk about a little bit more when it's my turn.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Cadigan. I want to pause here for a minute and ask for the approval of the minutes. Representative Bryant, would you like to move the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the minutes at the last meeting.
Okay, we have Representative Bryant move the approval of the minutes for January 16th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails, and the minutes for January 16th are approved. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Maggie Diebel. I'm the Director of the Community and Family Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. And as Karen said, I'm here along with our colleague from the Department of Human Services in recognition that we need to be working closely together in order to take a more holistic approach to addressing the needs of our kids. And she talked about some foundational elements, and certainly health is a key foundational element in our approach to doing this. So I want to talk a little bit about what that means and what we're doing in order to make sure that kids are growing to healthy, successful adults. The World Health Organization defines health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Physical, mental, and social, and I would add emotional health, are really critical to success in life. And we have now a much broader understanding of the circumstances that influence our having either good or poor health. So the chance of living a long life or dying prematurely is a result of, as Karen said, genetics, environmental exposure, behavior patterns, and actually to a much less extent, access to health care. where we spend, by the way, 80%, 80, more than 80% of our health dollars, as well as social circumstances. And these social circumstances we actually refer to as the social determinants of health. And they're the circumstances in which people are born, grow up, live, and age, and the systems that we put in place to deal with illness. And they are in turn shaped by a wider set of forces, economics, social policies, and politics. So I want to talk a little bit about, Karen again mentioned earlier, some of the things that influence how well kids develop and grow. And an example of that would be in the toxic stresses that kids are exposed to. So this is an example, again, of how these influences can play out. In addition to the role that these early experiences play on the achievement gap and educational outcomes that Karen shared, and that you all know so well, they also impact health outcomes much, much later in life. So this is an example of what we call adverse childhood experiences. There's a growing body of evidence to show that when a child is exposed to severe, frequent, and unrelenting stress without the buffering protection of adult support, it can profoundly impact the body's stress response systems. And you saw that in the example of the brain slide that was shown earlier. It can result in the disruption of typical brain development and chemistry. The largest study that was ever done, it was conducted in 1995 to 1997 in collaboration between Kaiser Permanente and CDC, looking at these adverse childhood experiences involving over 17,000 participants. It was through a set of questions that were incorporated into the CDC's supported behavioral risk factor surveillance system, that those experiences causing toxic levels of stress or trauma before age 18 were asked of these participants in the study. So these included physical, sexual, verbal abuse, mental illness of a household member, substance abuse, divorce, etc. And then these experiences were exposures were studied in relation to and ultimately linked to poor physical, mental health, chronic disease, lower educational development, lower economic success, impaired social success, etc. So in this slide, we're seeing an example of that relationship. So you will see that the colored bars are depicting the number of ACEs, as we call them, and the experience of heart disease in this slide. So you'll show that there is a positive correlation. The higher the ACE score, the greater the incidence of heart disease. The study showed that ACEs are alarmingly common. In the original study, two-thirds of those in had at least one ACE, and more than 20% had three or more ACEs. In 2011, Minnesota became the 18th state to include ACE questions in our behavioral risk factor surveillance system, and next week we will be releasing Minnesota's data, which are very reflective of the national data. Just one more slide to show that also depicts the correlation between ACEs and smoking. So you can see here that early initiation of smoking as well as current smoking are coincident with the number of ACEs. So again, there are critical development periods where negative or positive experiences have greater impact, and I think this is an example of more and more information that we're seeing that can tell us that as we move further and further upstream, we have a greater opportunity to impact outcomes. Bend the healthcare cost curve, drastically reduce disorders and disability, interrupt cycles of intergenerational poverty, decrease demands on social services and corrections, improve workforce productivity, et cetera. So I'll spend a little bit of time on how the Department of Health influences these outcomes through our programs. And we contribute to ensuring, again, very much further upstream some of these outcomes, so healthy births, as well as healthy physical, mental, social, and emotional development, so kids can be successful in school and life. So people may not commonly think of family planning as an early childhood program, but it is one of those programs that's foundational to ensuring that kids have a healthy start in life. We know that when pregnancies are planned, intentional, and well-spaced, there are much better outcomes. Women better prepare themselves by quitting smoking, avoiding alcohol, maintaining a healthy weight, taking vitamins such as folic acid that prevent birth defects. They receive earlier prenatal care, and that has been shown to improve birth outcomes. So, again, thinking more broadly about what are the things that are going to ultimately have an impact on kids being healthy and prepared to learn and be successful in life. The WIC program provides supplemental nutrition to pregnant and breastfeeding women. The focus is on provision of nutritional food that will help kids have the nutrients they need for healthy growth and development. We strongly promote breastfeeding as the best food for infants. It boosts immunity, prevents obesity, and has the additional benefit to helping create the attachment and relationship needed for kids to be mentally, emotionally, and socially healthy. Our public health family home visiting program provides public health nursing support to families at risk due to economic hardship, maltreatment, and other trauma. The services are delivered ideally prenatally through the early years of a kiddo's life. They've been shown to improve pregnancy outcomes, promote school readiness, prevent abuse and neglect, reduce juvenile delinquency, and promote family health and economic self-sufficiency. We're providing a child care health consultation under the Early Learning Challenge Grant to help ensure that there's a health focus in the standards for high-quality child care delivery. It's not just that the food provided in childcare settings is safe, but safe to eat, but we want to make sure that it provides good nutrition for growth and development so they have the energy and the nutrients they need to learn. The problem of obesity that we're experiencing as a state and nation often starts in early childhood. Then the last thing I'll talk about is the federal Title V Maternal Child Health Block Grant. And again, this is focusing upstream on preconception care that I mentioned a bit and prenatal care. We're now focusing some time on attention on ensuring that babies are not born too early, because we know that before 39 weeks, they haven't had sufficient time for brain development and other system development for them to be healthy. So, again, that's an example of our making sure that we're creating the environment in which kids can be healthy and grow. Identifying and addressing maternal depression is another example, where if we do that early, we can help to mitigate the toxic impact on infants and other kids in the family. We focus on promoting adolescent health and reducing teen pregnancy because children born to teenage moms are more likely to live in poverty, to be born at low birth weight, experience poor health and behavioral problems, and have a greatly increased risk of poor educational performance. So again, an example of the kinds of things that we need to be thinking about to have this more coordinated, holistic approach to ensuring that kids are successful. Thank you.
Thank you. And you have, we'll just take questions later. Do you have the next person?
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Orr. I work for the Department of Human Services and oversee an area called Community Partnerships and Child Care Services. Child care services at the state level works in partnership with counties, tribes, community organizations, and our other state agencies, health and education as part of the Office of Early Learning. And we're working to develop high quality and accessible child care options for families and to provide child care subsidies to low-income Minnesotans. A 2009 study of child care use in Minnesota conducted by Wilder Research found that an estimated 908,000 children aged 12 and under of that group of children, that 65% are regularly in some form of child care arrangement. We also know that in high-quality settings that we see providers with education and training that equips them to provide instruction to young children. It's that combination of high-quality child care settings and large number of children spending time with child care providers. That's a great opportunity to reach children very early and prepare them for school. I want to highlight two of the Department of Human Services programs within Child Care Services, Child Care Assistance, and Child Development Services, and then also provide an overview of Parent Aware. The Child Care Assistance Program, which is often referred to as CCAP, provides financial assistance to low-income families to pay for child care. We do that so that parents can go to work or participate in education leading to employment, and so that children are well cared for and prepared to go to school ready to learn. Child care assistance is actually two programs. One provides child care subsidies to families participating in the Minnesota Family Investment Program, or MFIP, or families that are recently transitioning off of the MFIP program. And then the second program, called the Basic Sliding Fee Program, provides a capped allocation to counties for child care subsidies to low-income families that aren't on MFIP. Families participating in the Basic Sliding Fee Program have to have incomes at or below 47% of the state median income, which is about $34,000 for a family of three at time of program entry. And then they are no longer eligible for the program when their incomes are greater than 67% of the state median income, which is about $48,500 for a family of three. Counties maintain a waiting list for the Basic Sliding Fee Program when they don't have funding for all eligible applicants. And the statewide waiting list in November 2012 was 6,178 families. About 33,000 children receive child care subsidies in an average month through one of those two programs. Families are expected to pay co-pays based on their income and family size, and they choose their providers in a private child care market. Maximum reimbursement rates paid through the Child Care Assistance Program are set by type of care. So there's rates for center-based care, rates for family child care, and legal non-licensed child care. And in 2011, about 27.6% of family child care providers and about 20.6% of child care centers had their rates fully covered by the maximum rates paid by the program. So there's quite a gap between the market rate and what the child care reimbursement rate is paying at this point in time. We do pay a higher reimbursement rate to providers who meet certain kinds of quality standards, accreditation, or certain kinds of credential standards. And about one-fifth of the children served by the Child Care Assistance Program receive care from a provider who meets these higher quality standards. And we'd like to see that number increase. And in 2011, about 43% of the children receiving child care subsidies were in a licensed child care center, about 31% were in licensed family care home, and then the remaining 26% were either in a non-licensed setting, like a legal non-licensed setting, often referred to as family, friend, and neighbors, or else in a license-exempt setting. And that sometimes is a school-based, school-age program. Child Development Services, that particular area focuses on increasing the quality of early care and education settings and school-age settings, and we provide grants and financial supports to providers for quality improvements. We provide training, mentoring, and coaching to providers on child development, instructional practices, and meeting the needs of individual children. We also reimburse providers for some of the costs associated with becoming accredited. Through child care resource and referral agencies across the state, parents get information to help make informed choices about child care for their children, and about 22,000 parents receive child care referrals through child care resource and referral agencies on an annual basis. The Child Development Services has lead responsibility for implementation of the statewide expansion of Parent Aware, which is Minnesota's quality rating and improvement system, and we're doing that in coordination with the Office of Early Learning. Parent Aware, I want to move on to the next slide. Mm-hmm. Is it up there? Oh, okay. Can't see without my glasses. It's a rating tool that helps parents shop for child care and other types of early education programs. And it's about helping providers improve quality, helping parents find quality, and helping children access quality. The tool provides a 1 to 4 star rating, which measures programs' use of best practices, which are most predictive of kindergarten readiness. And after 4 years of piloting the tool in 5 different communities across the state, Minnesota's receipt of the Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge grant is allowing us to expand statewide over the next few years. Implementation at the local level is being coordinated by the Minnesota Child Care Resource and Referral Network. Parent Aware is a voluntary program, and it's available to many different types of child care and early education programs, including home-based family, child care, center-based care, public and private preschool, and Head Start. There are 2 ways programs to receive a Parent Aware rating. Some programs are already meeting quality standards, like Head Start programs and pre-K school programs, and accredited child care programs. And for these programs, we recognize that they're already meeting some of those standards, and Parent Aware is available to them in every community in the state. There's an accelerated rating process for them. And then for the child care programs that aren't accredited, Parent Aware is rolling out over the next few years, and you see a map of the rollout, and it will be available in all Minnesota communities in 2015. And so the Parent Aware will be available, I think, in the Aqua counties, is available as of 2012, moves to the Purple counties in 13, Orange counties in 14, and the rest of the state in 2015. And as we're doing the rollout of Parent Aware, we're going to be assessing and evaluating implementation, and we'll make adjustments and recalibrate as needed. We want to make sure that we continuously improve the tool as it rolls out.
Great. I'm going to thank you so much, Mary and Maggie. I'm going to talk a little bit about the programs within the Department of Education. And just want to call to your attention, if you haven't oriented yourself to the Itasca report, which was done some 6 years ago now, it's a good thing to take a look at because it examined the way in which child care and early education is a $3 billion business in Minnesota over the biennium, and that the vast majority of that money, I think $1.2 billion, comes from parents' pockets, that child care and preschool is largely a private market, and the ways in which the public resources have been divided traditionally, there are some in health, but the large amount between the Department of Human Services, where child care lives, and the purpose of child care really is to allow parents to work and go to school and be successful. And then another sort of half similar chunk of public money is in the Department of Education, where there are programs whose mission is to support children's learning and development. For a variety of reasons, we are at a transition in what we know about science and about children's learning and about family economics, and that the distinction between care and education is really a somewhat artificial one when it comes down to what children experience, children and families experience. Nevertheless, our policies are still based on sort of this child care, early education. So you will often hear us using terms care and education or early education programs broadly. We'll come back to that slide. In the Department of Education, there are a handful of programs that are school-based. Those are school readiness programs, public, also known as public pre-K programs. Those are to serve at-risk 3- and 4-year-olds. Also, early childhood family education, which many people are familiar with, which is although it often includes an early education component, it's really to support parents. It's unique in the country to Minnesota, and it's a universal program so that all families, there's no eligibility or risk factor, all families can attend. In some districts, there's a sliding scale depending on the class and the district. And then early childhood screening. The early childhood screening program is administered through local school districts and or public health to help identify early delays or disabilities as early as possible in order to provide interventions for families and get kids back as close as possible to the path of normal development. other set of programs that live within the Department of Education are early childhood special education and Head Start programs. Early childhood special education serves preschoolers through to five-year-olds with disabilities and their families, serves a little over 15,000 children. Again, that's through school districts. And then what's known as Part C of IDEA is early intervention for infants and toddlers with disabilities, and that serves about 5,000. Those dollars include some federal money. And then Head Start. I think Head Start is an interesting program because a lot of people think, well, there are poor kids who need preschool services. Head Start takes care of that. Only in Minnesota, as in other states, only about a third of the eligible Head Start children are served. These are kids that are at 100% of poverty. Head Start serves 3 to 5 year olds. There are a little over something near 13,000 children in Head Start, and a little over 2,000 children in early Head Start. The other thing that relates to the sort of early childhood through grade 3 that lives in the Department of Education is our Reading Well by Third Grade initiatives and the programs that the agency leads to support that. A big piece of that is a planned expansion of all-day kindergarten, which you may have heard a little bit about yesterday. But then something else that has been in legislation for a little over a year now, which is to develop for districts to develop local K-3 literacy plans, which requires them to identify students who are in need of interventions and to work to support and remediate those interventions. Also requires districts to provide teachers and evidence-informed instructional practices to help kids read by third grade, and as an incentive about being intentional about this, early grade literacy districts are offered money for in a complicated formula that I am not going to try to explain. In addition to that, the Office of Early Learning, we're looking at how some other states do a pre-K through third framework. In order to figure out how these things fit together, you may be wondering, I see some eyes glazing over, how do all these things fit together? And how can they work better for families, and how can they have a better impact on the achievement gap? And one of the ways that we think about that is really has to do with systems. And when we talk about systems, it really doesn't refer to the size of something. It refers to something that has separate parts, has separate distinct parts. You'll see here that in this system, the parts are in silos or they're separate from each other. They don't impact each other. And in this current system that you just heard a very quick overview about, this is a little bit how things have been in Minnesota historically, that there are good programs, good providers, funding streams here and there, but they're not necessarily always all connected. And so the path that we're on right now, that Race to the Top allows us a blueprint for and some financial resources and accountability for, really has to do with adding a few things to this system that support everything individually and everything to work together. And two of the most important things of that are ParentAware, this quality rating scale that sets a common standard for quality for all our early education programs, and I'm sure you'll want to hear a lot more about that. And then the second thing are early learning scholarships. And so you'll see what can happen. The vision for Minnesota is to add in these components around the existing structures that are in place such that the infrastructure and programs are in place, but they all work together. That's our vision for how things could work. And again, there could be two things there and you want them working together, or eight separate things. The reality of where we are today is that we have 40-some years of policies and programs that were developed in a different time, really. So I want to tell you a little bit more about the early learning scholarships and Race to the Top, and then we're going to have time for questions and comments. So the goal of early learning scholarships is really about access. It's to provide children with access to high-quality programs so that they're ready for school. Eligibility guidelines for this are low-income children ages 3 to 5. And they can be used, they're public dollars, and so we want to have some accountability that they're going to programs that are of some degree of quality. So right now, early learning scholarships can be used in childcare, either family or center-based, Head Start or school-based pre-K, participating in Parent Aware. Families are eligible for up to $4,000 per eligible child. And this year, fiscal year 2013, we had $2 million available, which meant approximately 460 scholarships. And then the $3 million is enough for about 690 scholarships. So 460 scholarships, the number that we had for implementation this year, is enough to serve 1% of the state's lowest income 3- and 4-year-olds. So we had to make some choices about how to do that. The expansion of scholarships to $25 million a year will allow us to serve over 5,000 additional families. So, and I just want to show you the relationship between Parent Aware programs that are rated as having some quality, are rated and supported to move towards that quality, are eligible for these financial incentives and scholarships. And you'll see that just in the first year of implementation, full implementation of Parent Aware, that this is really a statewide initiative. Those blue dots represent where there are Parent Aware places throughout the state. So the Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge is a $45 million federal grant. It's a four-year grant. We are done with year one of implementation. We're one of nine states that were awarded in the first round. There's another five states that were awarded a couple of months ago. And the overall point of the federal plan is for state agencies, state policies to work together to access, for children to access high-quality, accountable programs. Having a statewide voluntary quality rating system was required for the application, and we, because we were on that path already, we're well positioned to do that. The other big bucket for helping improve access for children is a Title I incentive. And what that does, very interesting that we sort of thought about in response to what we had heard from superintendents and elementary school principals that wanted to use their Title I money for developing pre-K programs but found it challenging to take money away from third graders that you know to give to four-year-olds you don't yet know even. So starting this year, some school districts, and then starting next year, even more school districts will be eligible for incentive money, a dollar-for-dollar match, essentially, for every Title I dollar. The idea for that is to help redirect those federal funds that already exist and are sustainable more into the prevention rather than remediation line of things. We're really excited to see how that comes out. The other three buckets are really around promoting early learning and developmental outcomes, so having standards, we're looking at our early childhood indicators. A great workforce, and again, the competencies of early childhood providers. This, again, goes to child care providers, early childhood teachers, licensed preschool teachers, and the like. And then measuring outcomes and progress. We're relooking at how we do our state's kindergarten entry assessment and also designing a longitudinal data system across our three agencies that's somewhat similar to SLEDS, the cross-agency system that exists right now between MDE, the Office of Higher Ed, and DEED. That's a really quick rundown of Race to the Top. So I wanted to show you this. It helps depict a little bit. It's not the most perfect slide. Sort of the logic model, like why does all this matter, right? And that is that access. So in the red buckets, you'll see the big concepts, and in the white, you'll see some of the programs and funding streams. So access to high-quality, accountable programs results in improved school readiness and a strong start for learning in an aligned and high-quality K-3 setting, which leads to third-grade proficiency. So the challenge that we face today, all of us, I think, is getting from here to there. So I love this cartoon of two scientists looking at a formula with a problem and a solution, and in the middle they just hope for a miracle. So hopefully we'll do better than that. And I'll ask Maggie to come back up and join us. Is it okay for me to grab another chair, Peter?
Yes, please do.
Oh, there's another chair. Great. And we'll take your questions and comments. Thanks for listening to that long barrage.
Thank you. Just one comment. When you showed the previous slide on the different steps, access to high-quality, accountable programs leads to improved school readiness and learning and third-grade proficiency. I heard just recently that, well, we've said for a long time that third-grade reading skills can point to success later in life or the number of people we have in prison, that we can tell by how kids are doing at the third grade level. But I just heard recently that we can tell by age two, we can predict third grade reading skills. Mm. So there's tends to be a, quite a infrastructure that we need to build quite early. And so I emphasize again that at age two, we are not teaching reading, but we are setting it up for all those skills later that will predict outcomes in life. So we need to really attend to how we're taking care of our children early. Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to say I love the cartoon also, and I hadn't seen it before. And I leaned over to my colleague, Representative Winkler, and said, that's how we operate here in the legislature. And he leaned back to me and said, yes, we call it a mandate. So anyway. With that little bit of humor, I have a couple of serious questions. Mm-hmm. We heard in K-12 finance yesterday, testimony from the St. Paul Public Schools, and one of the issues that was raised that I have serious concern with is how the scholarship program relates to our school-based providers. They made a clear case that they really can't use the scholarships as they're currently structured because there's too close a connection between the scholarship being available and the space having to be there, and they plan a year ahead in terms of their classrooms and their providers, and so they feel that at this point they're kind of pushed to the side in terms of scholarships. I have concern about that, so that's my first question.
Madam Chair, Representative Reinert, thank you for that question. I share that concern. I have spoken with the department. We've spoken with many school districts about that and look forward to figuring it out together. This whole idea of scholarships, of resources following children, so that if a family decides to move from Duluth to Mankato or St. Paul to Wilmer, the child still has an opportunity to access a program. Is a really powerful one in terms of empowering families, and it's a big change in how things are funded. I think what we've learned, and they've been available, though there were some available in the pilot, they've really only been available statewide since November 1st. So again, this is all very new and a big change from the way we've done things for 40 years. I think the important points to know are that we are 110% committed to figuring out a way to make it work for school districts. And one of the first steps in that, I think, is highlighting and raising up some of the places around the state where it is working in school districts. In rural Minnesota, where they're always used to doing miracles with $80 and a ball of twine, for a variety of reasons, they are able to figure it out a little bit more quickly. That probably has to do with the scale and the numbers that they have. But we are committed to figuring out a way to make it work. We don't know what that looks like, but we really look forward to talking with school districts about doing that.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Yes.
Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the next issue, it maybe reflects off of that, but it's broader, and it relates to capacity and waiting lists. And a lot of our highly rated programs have waiting lists, whether they're school-based or not.
Sure.
And when you're talking, you know, you had the map up there with the ramp-up 3 years. How do we get to the point where we can serve these 5,000 additional families with the quality, with providers who are quality rated?
Dr. Cadigan?
Madam Chair, Resident Briner, you should join our team. You're asking all the right questions. So a few things about that. Number one is that we will continue to do it as fast as we can, and it probably won't be fast enough because kids are growing and aging every moment of every day. The waiting list issue is an interesting one. What we've heard from, and this is true across programs, child care, Head Start, and school-based programs, but I think even more so maybe in Head Start and school-based programs, is that they don't have the physical space. So remember, a scholarship provides for opportunity for the child. What it doesn't do right now is pay for the building, the upfront costs of hiring new staff, buying supplies, all of that. There's still that part of the infrastructure that needs to be built. I think there may well be other solutions at how that happens. And again, we're really looking at models for how communities are doing that, how they're figuring it out, and how they're planning for the future. So in ways to sort of blend and braid funds. So for example, Title I funds can be used for minimal kinds of remodeling of space, for example, to make it early childhood friendly, where scholarship dollars can't. But what we're really talking about is a new model for financing high-quality early childhood programs so that all providers have the opportunity to benefit and parents have choice. And there, I'm sure, will continue to be bumps to work out. And ideas for that are welcome, and everyone in the room here knows that.
Thank you. Representative Franson?
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who to direct this question to, but I'm looking for information on parent aware. I would like to see those that are participating in it, the counties that are participating in it, the number of providers in that county, including but not excluding Head Start, and then also the number of providers and Head Start 2 kept separate that are actually participating it as, you know, participating in the program. And then also I'm concerned about the government determining quality of care and taking the empowerment away from parents to determine quality of care. I used mm-hmm. to be a licensed child care provider. Mm-hmm. I do have children now in child care, but I think that, you know, my provider, I'm sure she would be given a 4-star, but even if she wasn't given a 4-star, I still think she's worth 4 stars. And so I think a lot of providers see themselves also as 4 stars, and the parents that bring their children to, I will always believe that parents are the best determinant and what quality of care is, and not, you know, a government agency. So I want to make sure that we are not telling certain providers out there because they've got a 2-star that they are not worth their, you know, the family's children going to that place where, you know, Head Start now, yet once again, has been in the news recently for it not being an effective program, but yet under the Parent Aware, Head Start is given their 4 stars. So,
Ms. Orr?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative. I don't have the information, and it would be a little tedious, I think, to share, but we can provide the committee with information by county and the types of providers that are participating, so we can follow up and provide that to the committee. And then to your second point, the purpose of Parent Aware, really, one primary purpose is to give parents information so that they can make their own choices about where they want their children to be. And so it's really to help parents make choices, not to take away those choices from them, and to provide them with the information. And that's really what we're trying to do with Parent Aware.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Branson?
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. And then if you could just ask me, in what other private business does the government give ratings to allow consumers to determine where they should go? I mean, I'm seeing just child care right now, but
Madam Chair, Representative.
Ms. Orr.
You know, I do think that there it might not be exactly comparable, but similar with nursing homes and long-term care facilities. I think there are tools to help individuals and family members help choose places for their mostly elderly, but not necessarily elderly parents. So in a similar way, I think it's really just providing parents as consumers with information so that they can make decisions and learn a little bit more about a provider and figure out if that's the best place for their children to be.
Thank you. Dr. Cadigan?
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Franson, I just want to make clear that I think your concern is a good one and a natural one, and that I think to all of us, the beauty of Parent Aware is not only that it helps put some accountability around public money and helps be a tool for parents to use, although I also have a child in child care right now, and it happens to be rated, but I wouldn't move even if it weren't. But also that it helps, and this has been one of the most powerful things of talking with providers, especially family child care providers around the state this year, is that it helps provide support to them and a lattice for them to take what's good and make it better. And although, you know, there certainly would be ways that you could do that are heavy-handed or unfair or not supportive, but that is not at all the spirit of what Parent Aware is about.
Representative Franson?
Thanks, Madam Chair. And then could you just clarify about those that have received a four-star, they're given like an award, a monetary award, correct, for their facility?
Ms. Orr?
Yep. Madam Chair, Representative. Programs that go through a full rating process, and that would be for the non-accredited child care programs, they would receive up to $1,000 to help with their, usually they have an improvement plan, and they do get some financial resources to help carry out that plan.
Representative Franson.
Thank you. And my suggestion would be for those that are receiving maybe a 1-2 star, that we kind of look at incentivizing them, you know, to help better their quality of care instead of just, you know, the 4 stars. They're receiving a 4-star.
Ms. Orr?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, I should clarify. Actually, it's the 1, 2, 3 star that get the improvement dollars. The 4-star programs would not get the improvement dollars. Sorry for that, Ms.
Okay, thank you. Representative Myra?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions. Dr. Cadigan, you know, in this continuum of brain development, what is the time that is most crucial for their learning literacy?
Dr. Cadigan?
Madam Chair, Representative Myra, wouldn't it be great if there was 1 week in every year and we knew that was the week and we could direct all our resources there? I think I'm not sure that we can say that the challenging thing about brain development is that I'm not sure we can say that this exact period is the most open. What we know, though, is that in the earliest years, the first 3 years of life especially, children learn important foundational skills that are really the precursors to reading. So the gaps that exist there or the skills that exist there predict that. It's not literacy or reading. It's really about vocabulary and language development that sets the stage for real reading to occur. That being said, certainly there are children that don't have those skills and go on, but in terms of from a group standpoint, having some of the most interesting early interventions that have proven effective have been curriculum that helps support grown-ups' ability to talk more and in more supportive ways and in more variety of ways to young children. It's kind of funny sometimes to talk to 18-month-olds because they don't always talk back, but talking with them is really important. I'm not sure if that helps answer the question.
It does.
Representative Myra?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, Is there a particular time where we're seeing brain development kind of, you were talking about the cement setting. When is it, when is the biggest bang for your buck? I mean,
when is the cutoff?
Yeah. when is it harder to see the achievement and growth?
Dr. Cadigan?
Madam Chair, Representative Myra, again, I wish I had an easy answer for that. It's, you know, the great thing about human brains is that they continue to change throughout our lives. Thank goodness, right, that we can all at least try to continue to learn new skills. And so I think, you know, with brain development, especially when we're talking about children's learning and development, the big, one of the big things to pay attention to is not necessarily what does the brain look like, but what are the skills that children possess as a result of that. And again, I think that there is so much evidence about both language and literacy skills, executive functioning skills, which are those things about paying attention, sitting still, self-regulation, sort of the air tower control center of the brain, that the skills that are developed early in the first 3, 4, 5 years are really critical, laying a foundation for other things that go on top of them.
Right, Madam Chair.
Representative Myra.
Thank you. Doctor, I've been studying the Finnish model. They have test scores that Minnesota is always trying to catch up to. Mm-hmm. They actually don't start teaching academics until 7 years old. Mm-hmm. I find that very intriguing. They really like to have a very nurturing, safe environment, really emphasize creativity. I think there is sometimes, you know, these words of child care and education sometimes get a little bit confused, and I think a lot of times parents think education means that those strong academics. And can you comment on that, please?
Madigan.
Madam Chair, Representative Myra, it's one of my favorite ways to talk with superintendents who might not know that much about early development, that developing, you know, programs for 3 and 4 year olds does not include tiny desks. Learning looks very different for young children, and really the most important part of all human learning, but especially for young children, is the quality of the relationships they're in. So it certainly doesn't require flashcards or even, you know, fancy toys of any kind. It requires a responsive, consistent, nurturing caregiver. And when we talk about the quality of environments, whether it's Head Start or a center-based classroom or a public pre-K, family child care, whatever it is, the main moderator, mediator of quality is really both of the quality that happens is the grown-up, and the buffer against any stress is the grown-up.
Thank you. I do have another question, Madam Chair.
Representative
Myra. Right. Thank you. This question is for Ms. Diebel. I'm very intrigued by, you shared a little bit about the health family home visiting. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? What are the age groups? How many families are served? Is this a program that's well-funded? Or?
Madam Chair and Representative, the Public Health Family Home Visiting Program in Minnesota is laid out in statute. And it's funded through TANF dollars, $7.8 million a year that goes out to our local public health agencies that administer the program. And again, we have evidence to show that for that this investment offsets a total of about $4,550 per family served in regard to other resources that those families would consume. So in addition to the TANF dollars, we also have federal dollars under the Maternal Infant and Early Childhood Home Visiting Program, which are evidence-based home visiting programs. We use two models in that program. We get about $10 million a year. And again, that is directed by the federal government based on a set of indicators that put families at risk. And so we allocate, again, those funds to community health boards in the state that through a set of risk indicators indicate that they're at highest risk for adverse outcomes. And again, those models are fairly directive in terms of what the program entails, and the research shows that if they're implemented with fidelity, that again we can see better outcomes in regard to decreased child abuse, better educational outcomes, etc. So it's really based on public health nurses establishing relationships, as Dr. Cadigan was talking about, with the family to increase parenting skills, promote economic self-sufficiencies, ensuring that there's appropriate referrals to other services that they might need. And this is an effort to ensure that broader coordination that those families can succeed. So again, in one model, ideally, pregnant women are identified early, you know, again prior to birth, and then supported through a period of time with certain inputs. Overall, let's see, we're just actually telling numbers for last year, but in the previous year, we served about 32,000 families through this program throughout the state. And there are different models that are employed by the community health boards and local public health departments. But again, we're focusing on these evidence-based programs that we know show positive outcomes.
Representative Meyer?
Madam Chair, Ms. Diebel, so are those federal funds? I'm sorry. Are those federal funds or
yes,
state funds?
They're federal
okay.
funds.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And then one last question. Ms. Orr? Madam Chair, Ms. Orr, how onerous are the is the mm-hmm. process for becoming Parent Aware certified? Is it a long process? Is it expensive? What's involved in doing that?
Ms. Orr?
Madam Chair, Representative, I mentioned that there were two avenues. One was the accelerated
right.
For programs that already have some quality aspects built in. And then for the full rating process, we basically do it in six-month cohorts basically allow for that six-month period of time for them to kind of follow through with what they need to do in order to satisfy the standards. But we allow that amount of time. And one of the neat things, I think, about the rollout is that providers and counties that are in rollout years to come can start working on building quality and starting to get ready for Parent Aware when it's time to arrive in the county that they live in. But we do allow 6 months, really, time frame in order for them to get that rating at the end of the 6 months.
Madam Chair, one last question.
Representative Ira,
is that costly to do that?
Ms. Orr?
Madam Chair, Representative, it kind of depends on where the provider is starting from. And so, you know, one of the reasons we do provide the $1,000 that I spoke about, it helps offset some of the costs that they may acquire or in becoming qualified. We also have, through Race to the Top and other federal quality dollars, some funding to help offset, for example, purchase of curricula and assessment tools. So we do have some resources that are available to offset the cost, depending, again, where that provider is at and where they need to improve.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to make a comment that we'll be looking at Parent Aware more next week. And also, I can see three areas of responsiveness to children. One would be an example of myself with five children, and yet in spite of experiences in my life and education in my life, still being able to take early childhood family education helped fine-tune, point out things, bring awareness, and support that whole process. And I think it's a wonderful program for anyone who wants to take it. And then we have people on the other end, as Representative Meyer is pointing out, for people who are in less have less opportunity, and the family home visit team serves very well in modeling. Besides connecting them to things, it also provides them with modeling of how to interact with their child, how to be a responsive, nurturing adult, build that so that they too can then do that with their children. And then in between, we have the places where we put our children, many different, whether it's a child care center or whether it's a neighbor or a grandparent or the family, friends, and neighbors, whatever we call them. Those can be parents and grandparents themselves, but still, for them to have the opportunity to increase their awareness and understanding of how to be a responsive, nurturing adult, heavens, why wouldn't we want to provide this in all three areas? So it's an excellent program. Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, have quite a number of questions, and I know we'll talk more about Parent Aware. Ms. Orr, you're from the Department of Human Services, and this is not the topic of this hearing, but I do understand that there was a important Star Tribune investigation over the summer related to child mortality in child care settings, and I know there's been some potential recommendations from the department related to that, and as well as some concern among providers. And I don't know if that's scheduled for discussion or hearing in this committee or not, but I wonder if you could just let us know if you're going to be coming forward with a set of proposals or recommendations just related to safety and training.
Ms. Orr?
Yep, Madam Chair, Representative. You're right. There was the Star Tribune series, and then there was a subgroup of the Child Mortality Panel that met and provided recommendations to the Commissioner of Department of Human Services, a set of recommendations to address the issue of safe sleep. And there will be, so basically the department is considering those recommendations and will be proposing recommendations to be moving forward with. Some would require legislation, some may require budget, and then some can be implemented administratively. So there will be recommendations coming forward from the department that I think this committee will want to hear about.
Hey, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know who the best person to answer this question is, but this actually question comes from my wife, who is on the board of an early childhood center where our kids attend preschool or have attended preschool and daycare, and it's part of our church. And she mentioned the fact that this center has been accredited by what I imagine is a national accreditation body. It was quite a significant effort to get that accreditation. The question is very specific, which is, if you are already accredited by some reputable organization, is that kind of an automatic in to the Parent Aware program?
Ms. Orr?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative. Right now, and I'm looking for accuracy, but there are some accreditations that are listed in statute for purposes of the Child Care Assistance Program, and I mentioned we pay a higher reimbursement rate for those accreditations. And we look to that same group of accreditations for Parent Aware and which programs would qualify for the accelerated rating. So
pretty much yes?
I wouldn't say that every accrediting organization is recognized, but their statute recognizes a certain set of accrediting organizations for purposes of child care assistance. Okay, I guess I'm going to get some help.
Would you introduce yourself and proceed?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deb Swenson-Klatt with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, Child Development Services. And as Mary mentioned, in statute are listed a set of accrediting bodies that are currently tied to the accreditation rate differential. So I'll just name them. They include the National Association for the Education of Young Children, the Council on Accreditation, the National Early Childhood Program Accreditation, the National School Age Care Association, and the National Head Start Association Program of Excellence, also the American Montessori Society, and the Association of Montessori International USA.
Thank you. Representative Winkler?
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Orr, I don't know, maybe you can answer this. If you have those accreditations, does that create a direct on-ramp for the Parent Aware program, or do you have to kind of step through that next hoop, even though you've already gone through a lot of work to get accredited?
Madam Chair, Representative, so if you have one of these accreditations, you would be eligible for an accelerated rating under the Parent Aware. So it recognizes that you've already met some quality standards, but there are two additional steps that child care provider would need to do, and one has to do with the use of a curricula and the other with the use of assessment. So it does put you on the path. And I guess I would like to just make one other clarification, because the legislature was interested in the issue of accreditation last year and asked us to look at an alternative to listing organizations in statute like it is done right now, and rather look at criteria for accrediting bodies. And so there will be a report to the legislature that the Department of Human Services worked on together with the Department of Education and Health, and that report's due to the legislature in mid-February.
Okay, thank you. Representative Winkler, do you have more?
Sorry, I don't know how many people you have in your list.
No, you're it.
Okay. These can kind of be boiled down. It's probably, again, can be answered by anyone, but we have the proposal from Many Minds, and generally to expand these scholarships, is to layer scholarships on top of the existing sliding fee program and the child care assistance program, as I understand it. And to your point, there's really no difference between education and care, in my experience anyway, as a parent. So is there a reason for layering as opposed to integrating these funds together and creating one program? And as a follow-up, once you add up all this money, is it actually enough for families of very limited means to be able to afford a high-quality program?
Dr. Cadigan?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I think I'm not sure I can speak to the details of the child care financing world, but I think I would say, going back to the system piece, that it's not part of the idea of scholarships is not just layering, but putting them in places where they actually promote good. So one example of how scholarships can work with child care assistance is that families still have co-pays, and there are continuity of care issues sometimes for families. So scholarships can help fill the gaps when families. $4,000, which is the amount of scholarships right now, is certainly not enough to pay for quality care. I have the most recent stats here. Metro infant center-based care can be as high as almost $15,000 a year. In Greater Minnesota, four-year-old family child-based care can be closer to $6,000, but that's really the range of the actual cost of care, no matter what the quality, even if we're not sure what the quality is. So I think there are a number of things, again, to look at in terms of what's the right number and what's the right financing structure. And we look forward to figuring out, having the good fortune to figure out those details.
Representative Winkler, do you have more?
Well, Madam Chair and Dr. Cadigan, it's, you know, yesterday the governor's budget included at least a dollar figure for scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Many Minds has a proposal in concept, but without any particular bill language yet. And I guess the question is, how long are we going to have to figure out how we're going to make this work and create a system that's going to work well, given, you know, if this is the budget setting year, if we're going to be applying significant resources to it, it has to be done right. Is it going to be done quickly?
Dr. Cadigan?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, again, we will move as fast as we can, and it may not be fast enough. I do want to say, though, that the part of the question about financing is, you know, the solutions that have been attempted to solving the problem of early opportunity gaps, later achievement gaps, have really been around funding programs or funding specific funding streams, really for over 40 years. That's been the method of trying to make things better. And that hasn't, you know, nearly half of our kids aren't ready for school. That hasn't really worked. And so this is a new way to figure it out. And I think this initial year of implementation, initial handful of months of implementation, is very promising. But there is a lot to figure out. And I think a critical part and a critical commitment, I think, on our part from the state agencies is to do that in a way and to have the flexibility for our administration to do that in a way that is that involves a continuous improvement process, that we don't set out a way to do it and then stick with that and not adapt to what we learn from the community. So I feel sometimes like I'm weaseling out of actual answers, but that's the best I can do for now.
Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just a comment along those lines, I guess, is I know that in the original MELF proposal a few years back now, there was the intention and interest in merging these lines of funding, you know. And I have some concern that we are cautious about that in the sense that, well, I understand. I mean, your gears are a good example, I think, you know. Clearly, we want those funding streams connected and complementary, but whether they ought to be merged is not yet clear. And I have a lot of questions about the scholarship method being a primary method. Should it be there? Should it be one among many? But it should it be the model? I'm not convinced yet. So I'd like to see some of these systems coexisting and us looking at the data in a clearer way. I have questions about alignment. You know, we have four-star programs that are within, you know, the child care community, and then we have four-star programs that are in our schools. And we don't know yet how those, whether there's differentiation among those four-star programs. I think we need to do a lot of data gathering before we begin to merge the streams. That's just a note of caution I have, so as opposed to Representative Winkler's point of view.
Well, thank you for coming, Dr. Cadigan and Ms. Orr and Ms. Diebel. Appreciate your testimony. I think it's been very enlightening. And members, we have a joint hearing with Environmental Finance next Tuesday, the 29th, at 8:15 in the morning. So with that, committee is adjourned.